around average for today. We'll have cloudiness tonight and a low of 59. It's 11 o'clock.
Within 72 hours of a baby being born, hospitals are supposed to take a blood test to see whether the newborn may have any unexpected conditions or disorders. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She says many hospitals in the U.S., including some in Arizona, aren't doing a good enough job with the testing and are putting babies at risk. I'll also speak with Mary Ellen Cunningham of the Arizona Department of Health Services about how the agency is working to improve the situation. Plus, the Arizona Board of Regents is making a bold proposal asking state lawmakers and the governor to authorize the sale of $1 billion in bonds to improve research facilities at the state's three public universities. I'll get details from Board of Regents President Eileen Klein. And former astronaut Mark Kelly will be in Scottsdale on Friday with his wife, former Representative Gabrielle Giffords. We'll talk about overcoming challenges and the battle over new gun legislation. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Ceremonies, documentaries, and TV specials are honoring the legacy of the late President John F. Kennedy and will continue to do so through this Friday, which will mark 50 years since the day the revered American leader was assassinated. He was killed just weeks before the newly established Presidential Medal of Freedom was to be presented to Americans considered champions of the American dream. Kennedy is gone, but his legacy endures. 50 years later, 16 additional Americans are joining an elite list as the latest recipients of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Here's NPR's Ari Shapiro at the White House.
President Obama said this year's ceremony has special significance. It's the 50th anniversary of the award. More than 500 people have received the honor since President John F. Kennedy established it. Obama honored each of the recipients with a brief description of their biography and accomplishments.
Early in Oprah Winfrey's career, her bosses told her she should change her name to Susie. I have to pause here to say I got the same advice.
Other honorees included President Bill Clinton, the late astronaut Sally Ride, country singer Loretta Lynn, and former Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.
Florida Congressman Trey Radel has pleaded guilty to possession of cocaine. NPR's Tamara Keith reports Radel will be on supervised probation for a year.
The freshman Republican congressman admitted in court documents to buying 3.5 grams of cocaine from an undercover officer in Washington, D.C. last month. When agents from the DEA and FBI approached, he dropped the drugs on the street, but then agreed to speak with them back at his apartment. There, he admitted to purchasing the cocaine and provided agents with a vial of the drug he had at his apartment. Radel said in a statement yesterday that this charge provides him with an opportunity to seek treatment for an alcohol problem that led him to make, quote, an extremely irresponsible decision. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The U.S. and Afghanistan are scrambling to draft a security agreement that could keep a limited number of American troops in Afghanistan past the end of next year when foreign combat forces were due to withdraw. Efforts to finalize the pact stalled yesterday over Afghanistan's request that the U.S. issue a letter of apology for civilian casualties and other issues of dispute during the Afghan war. Meanwhile, senior Afghan officials are now in Pakistan to initiate peace talks with the Afghan Taliban. A dozen deaths have been reported in accidents across Algeria where people had been celebrating the team's entry to the 2014 World Cup Finals of Soccer. Hundreds of people have been injured. At last check on Wall Street, Dow is up 19. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from T. Rowe Price, presenting T. Rowe Price Connections, a series exploring opportunities in the global economy at TRoePrice.com/connections.
From KJZZ News in Phoenix, I'm Bruce Drummond. The future management of the government's Mexican gray wolf reintroduction program is the focus of a hearing today in Albuquerque. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert has more.
Environmentalists, landowners, and others are expected to pack the session to comment on two proposals that will determine how the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proceeds on its effort to return the wolf to the southwestern U.S. One calls for listing the Mexican gray wolf as an endangered subspecies and delisting gray wolves elsewhere. The other proposal would revise a rule that classifies the Mexican wolves as an experimental population. Wolf supporters blame wildlife managers for failing to do enough to help the wolves repopulate parts of eastern Arizona and western New Mexico. Ranchers oppose any plans to expand the reintroduction program or increase the size of the area in which the wolves can be released. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
The only two uranium mines operating in Arizona and an associated mill in southern Utah are set to cease operations temporarily due to declining prices for the ore. Energy Fuels Resources announced this month that resources at its Arizona 1 mine will be depleted in early 2014. The company says the Pine Nut mine north of the Grand Canyon and the White Mesa Mill in Blanding, Utah will be placed on standby next year. The move comes after the company halted shaft sinking operations at another mine south of the Grand Canyon near Tucson. A company spokesman says the company will maintain the site so they can begin operating when the uranium market improves. Prices for uranium have dropped to the mid-$30 per pound on the spot market, a five-year low.
KJZZ is supported by Jerry's Audio Video, serving the Valley since 1970, offering in-home consultation and custom design of digital home theater systems. More info at jerrysav.com, a proud member of Local First Arizona.
In the Valley forecast, look for mostly cloudy skies today and a high of 76 degrees. More clouds tonight. Our low will drop down to about 59 and then cloudy again on Thursday with a high of 74. Right now, with relative humidity at 39%, it's partly sunny in Phoenix and it's 71 degrees at 11:06.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Later this hour, I'll talk with Mark Kelly, retired astronaut and husband of former Representative Gabrielle Giffords. Kelly and Giffords will be in Scottsdale on Friday. Plus, the Arizona Board of Regents is making a bold proposal for $1 billion in bonds for new research facilities for the state's three public universities. I'll speak with Board of Regents President Eileen Klein. Also, Arizona lawmakers are expected to look at Stand Your Ground in the next legislative session that starts in January. I'll talk with a couple of the panelists taking part in a Saturday event on the topic. We start today's program with a look at newborn screening. On Sunday, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel published an in-depth report on how states are doing with the requirement to draw a bit of blood from newborns and have the blood tested for a number of possible conditions or disorders within 24 to 72 hours. According to the data, Maryvale Hospital in Phoenix had the worst record last year, with 70% of newborn screening samples arriving at the state's testing lab at least 5 days after they were collected. Coming up, I'll talk with Mary Ellen Cunningham of the State Department of Health Services about what's being done to improve the situation. First, though, I'm joined by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Ellen Gabler, who put together the investigative package for the paper. Hi, Ellen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. What led you to believe this was a really extensive report? So what led you to believe this was a problem that wasn't being talked about or reported on?
Well, one of our other reporters here got a tip that something like this had happened to a baby in Wisconsin. And we've heard that these blood samples can be delayed. They cannot be sent right away from the hospital. So we started looking around, and we noticed that on the websites of many state labs, there's a warning that says, send these blood samples within 24 hours of collection. It's very important for the baby. The child can die if this doesn't happen. So when we saw that, we started thinking, maybe there's something here.
And how many states gave you full detailed numbers, and how many held out a bit?
Well, so I requested data from every single state in the country and the District of Columbia. I ended up getting data with hospital names from 26 states, and 24 states have refused to release the information. So that means parents in those states have no idea how their hospitals stack up.
So when they refused to release the information, was there a consistent line with that? Did some states say something different from others about why they wouldn't give you the information?
They said a variety of things. Mostly they said it was a privacy issue, which isn't really accurate, because we did not ask for the names of children, and we also did not even ask for, we didn't ask for any test results. All we were asking for was data from when a sample was collected to when it arrived at the lab. Several of the state labs were concerned that releasing this information was adversarial to the hospitals. And one state even said that releasing this information to us would reveal hospitals' business practices.
Okay. Now, there actually were, I want to say, just a couple of states that seemed to be doing the right thing and doing things well at this point. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. There are a couple states that do a great job of this, and there are hospitals throughout the country, in fact, that pay particularly close attention to this. Iowa was one of the states that does a great job that we highlighted in the story, and there's a couple reasons for that. Number one, their lab is not closed on the weekend. Your lab in Arizona is closed on the weekends. Mm-hmm. They also have an extensive courier system in Iowa, and they also have regulations there to send the samples within 24 hours. But, you know, one interesting thing about Arizona is there also is a courier system set up in your state that's paid for by the state lab, but not everybody uses it.
Well, I mentioned that based on the numbers, Maryvale Hospital in Phoenix did especially poorly. What reaction did you get from the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association? Were they unaware? Are they going to try to do something different? What did they tell you?
Yeah, well, I spoke with the head of Arizona's newborn screening office, and he said, you know, as you pointed out, there are hospitals here that need extra attention. And it seemed like this wasn't something that they had looked at on a comprehensive basis, you know, looking at hospitals. And Arizona wasn't the only one that had had problems with that. And so when we let them know, you know, about our analysis and let them know what we found, the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association said that they're going to conduct a training event for hospitals throughout the state to, you know, remind them of the state regulations and also remind them of this courier service that all hospitals in Arizona do have access to. It's just that some of them aren't using it.
Ellen, I want to come back to the core of your piece because it's not just numbers. There were very emotional stories in it as well. You have a number of examples in there. What are the possible risks? I mean, really let listeners know the possible risks, even if they're extremely rare, of these samples being late and not being tested as early as they should be.
Well, so the newborn screening is amazing, actually. It was developed about 50 years ago, and what it has allowed us to do is to identify kids who have these rare but very serious genetic disorders. And about 1 in 800 kids has one of these disorders. And if the condition is caught early and treated, the child can live a normal life. If it's not, though, they can become extremely ill. There's one condition called galactosemia where the child essentially can't digest the sugar in breast milk. Mm-hmm. Or formula. And so if you keep feeding the child breast milk or formula, their body starts to shut down and they get severe infection. They can experience brain damage. Their organs start to shut down. And, you know, this is stuff that can happen within a few days of life. And, you know, it's irreversible harm.
Yeah, one example you have, I mean, there are many troublesome examples in there, but one that hit me especially hard was this idea that the baby wasn't able to keep any food down, and the mom is told, okay, you know, it's fine, and then you take the child to the doctor, and the doctor's not able to figure out what's going on. It must be so scary, and you obviously talk to parents for the piece as well.
Yes, I spoke with a lot of parents, and what became kind of alarming was that I kept hearing the same stories over and over again. So, you know, the child is born, they seem healthy at birth, they're 8 pounds, you know, they look great, they take them home, they're not great feeders, they're spitting up a lot. They become lethargic. They become gray. You know, this kind of stuff. And so it's the same story. But the doctors didn't always know what was wrong. And in these cases, the tests hadn't come back. So they didn't know. And the newborn screening tests would have told them what the problem was.
Ellen, what's being done, if anything, to standardize rules across the country for newborn screening?
Well, so that's a major problem in this country for, and we talked about this in the article, but for about 15 years, federal regulators and health officials have realized that there really aren't any standards. And newborn screening is run on a state-by-state basis, and some places do a great job and some places don't do a great job. So there is definitely a lack of coordination and a lack of standardization. You know, now the Association for Public Health Laboratories, after hearing about our report, is trying to, institute some more standards. And it sounds like something, there might be more discussions at a federal level as well.
Good. Okay. Ellen, finally, what penalties, if any, are meted out for not following the rules? Are there penalties that hospitals or states have to face?
We did not find any instances where there were penalties, and that's why I think some of these state labs feel that they are in a little bit of a tough position. So they can't they can't really do anything if these hospitals aren't sending the samples in quickly. But the places that have been successful, the reason they've been successful is because they track this consistently. So they give hospitals a monthly report or a quarterly report to let them know how they're doing. And I really do think the hospitals want to do a good job with this. It's just that they might not be aware of what their track record is, or, you know, they might not be aware of the proper thing to do.
Ellen Gabler, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can find her in-depth story on newborn screening at our website, kjzz.org. later this afternoon. Ellen, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
To focus more specifically on newborn screening and what's being done in Arizona, I spoke earlier with Mary Ellen Cunningham. She's the chief of the Bureau of Women's and Children's Health at the Arizona Department of Health Services. Mary Ellen, how does the process work in Arizona, and where does the Department of Health Services fit in?
Within between 24 and 72 hours, we need to test the babies to see if they have any conditions that could be life-threatening to them. Most babies are well. Most babies don't have any problems. But there are a number of conditions that when a baby's born, it's not obvious. The babies look fine. When babies go home in 2 days, maybe they're still fine. But there's a number of conditions that can be detected through a simple blood spot. We used to, in the old days, call this PKU, when that was the only test that was being done. But now Arizona actually tests for 28 different abnormalities or conditions, disorders, that are inherited. So what happens is a nurse or someone in the hospital within 24 to 72 hours, but actually, that's what statute says, or the rule says, but we really know that closer to 36 is better. So they're going to do a little prick on the baby's heel and get a little drop of blood. There's a specially made card. It's kind of cardboard looking, and they'll have three different little drops of blood that have to fit in there. Then that goes, in most cases, to the lab, and the lab sends it to our lab, the state hospital. We're average of the states, where we test for about 28 things. Some states a little bit, well, they're about there, but there's some states that test for a few more. But
So that's determined by a state, then? It's not a federal?
It is actually determined by the state, and there's a committee, there's an advisory committee, that's also a part of the statute, of who determines these things. And so it's scientists, it's doctors, it's specialists in the fields, parents, there's all kinds of folks who are part of that. And they look at what's out there, what's a possibility. They look at how often the condition happens. Frankly, they look at cost as well, and make the decisions of how many tests we're going to have. We know that if we find a baby's hearing problem early, it makes a dramatic difference in that child's life as well. So where most hospitals, because of science, had started testing babies' hearing, we actually just put into rule that, or statute, that the hearing test had to come to the Department of Health so we could follow up on that. There's another test that we may likely go to called CCHD. It's critical congenital heart disease. That's the little test where they put the oxygen counter, what a little thing on the baby's finger.
Okay.
So it's not invasive, and then they can tell the babies, and they can detect several different abnormalities of a heart. The hospitals in Arizona, the medical community, the perinatal community, is very interested in the best outcomes for babies in Arizona, and so we're moving to things even without having to be told to.
We know, based on this Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article, which took a 5-year look at things, that there were some hospitals in Arizona that had been struggling, but when you look at a 5-year overview, is there reason to think that things have gotten actually better in the past couple of years?
The article was startling, and it was important. It was important for people to understand the very importance of these, of detecting these conditions in a timely manner. We had started at the Department of Health, Arizona Department of Health Services, in the newborn screening program maybe 3 years ago, looking at this by ourselves, looking at it, analyzing it, and deciding where the concerns were, and have worked with the community partners. The article even said that there was the reduction went from 29% to 17% in 2 years. There's been dramatic change in the last couple of years, as there's been an opportunity within the newborn screening program to go to these hospitals that are outliers and say, here are your numbers. The program manager will bring sometimes a case, a particular baby that was from that hospital, and say, here's baby Smith. Here's what happened. You did the test on time, but we didn't get it. Here's the condition the baby had. Hopefully they're going to say, thank God that there was no adverse reaction or outcome, but it brings it personal to a family, into a, into a hospital situation. So there has been a dramatic difference. We also realized that sometimes in facilities, maybe the right people weren't understanding the importance of the timeliness of the test. So there's an organization in Arizona called the Arizona Perinatal Trust, which is a community organization, a nonprofit, a 501c3. It's actually been around since the early 70s. And it part of what it does is to certify levels of newborn intensive care or perinatal care. Mm-hmm. And these are based on national standards. So this is a step, or sometimes several steps, above licensing. And in the end, most hospitals that deliver babies in the state are certified by the Perinatal Trust. Well, this Perinatal Trust also goes around for site visits every 3 years to kind of review. And it's a team of peers. So there'll be a neonatologist and a perinatologist who will go to a different hospital. Mm. So they're looking at someone else's things, and a labor and delivery nurse and a nursery nurse who, not in their own hospital, another hospital, and provide support to the other hospitals. There's been times that I've been on a site visit where somebody might say, well, this one policy that you have is not the latest that's out there. I just did it. Let me send it to you. It's an astonishing thing, really, that in a competitive world, this is one time we're the team together. So we started, the Bureau of Women and Children's Health started partnering with Newborn Screening a few years ago, and we bring a report to that hospital about the timeliness of test, among other things, the quality of the test. Mm. And then we are able to report out at the table where there's the CEO, the chief nursing officer, other people who might be more in a position to make change in the hospital.
Are there any specific examples you can offer?
We were at a hospital, and the nurses were startled when we told them that we're not getting test results in a timely manner. And they were horrified and said, we absolutely do them. We send them to the lab. And we said, well, this is what we have. And so that hospital, of course, turned around right away to look at their own processes to see what was different. Well, bless their hearts, someone in the lab thought that they were going to help us out by saving money by waiting till there were several tests. These tests need to be there on time. The state Department of Health will actually pay for the courier to deliver the test every day. There's no reason to wait. So we're finding between all of us, but especially our newborn screening folks, that they have gone all over the state, and they look to some of the hospitals that didn't rank quite as well on that report, and either they've only been there a few times. The other thing is, those hospitals, for the most part, have smaller numbers, and when there's only a few people to do the work, you go to the hospitals that have the higher volume. So they certainly were on the list anyway, and they will be on the list to offer support to the hospitals. It's important to remember, every one of these hospitals wants good babies. So it's often just a matter of understanding what happens in the, frankly, just the process of getting it to the lab, and that we can take care of this and get it done.
Mary Ellen, I appreciate what you're saying about improving the situation, but how concerning is it that we've been in this situation at all? This idea that the newborn screening, even innocent mistakes, were still made at such a level at some of the area hospitals?
We are absolutely concerned. Every baby's life is precious and important. And that's why the focus has been so strong in the last 2 years on getting to these hospitals, on bringing it to a personal level in the hospitals of who what their babies would look like, and then turning to the hospitals and saying, how can we help you to fix this? Okay. And every time the hospitals are very anxious to partner with us to get it done. It's an enormous concern to everybody.
Are you optimistic that things will get better as more communication increases?
We are absolutely optimistic. And as we look at our internal numbers for the past 2 years, and the report even spoke to it, there's been dramatic difference in what's happening. And it's complicated, but it's not complicated. In the end, you get the blood from the baby, you send it to the lab sends it to our newborn screening lab, and then we get the results and call back. That's another part that can sometimes we can run into some problems. For the most part, it's pretty routine that we call back the physician on record, and if there's an abnormal result, we'll also try to contact the family. There have been some times that we can't find the family, and if it's a life-threatening condition, we will use other resources. We have nurses that follow babies who have been in the NICU, for instance, who are in most communities of the state. We'll call them, and they will go out and find a family if they can't. If many times, there are families that don't like to give their name or address for many different concerns. And so that can be a challenge, is to find the baby again. But we do. And there have been, not often, but there have been a few times that we'll actually call the police and ask them to go help us find somebody. The folks in our newborn screening lab will find a baby no matter what.
Mary Ellen Cunningham is chief of the Bureau of Women's and Children's Health for the Arizona Department of Health Services. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about Stand Your Ground in Arizona. Plus, the president of the Arizona Board of Regents, Eileen Klein, joins me to talk about what the state wants to do as far as funding research facilities. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. Over the Thanksgiving holiday, encouraging travelers to save time by parking in the terminal and walking to your gate. Thanksgiving rates at skyharbor.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. We have a lot of clouds in the forecast across the state today. Right now, it's cloudy and 44 degrees in Flagstaff, cloudy and 43 up at the Grand Canyon, 53 degrees and cloudy in Prescott. In Tucson, it's partly sunny and 69 degrees, partly sunny and 70 in Yuma. In Valley traffic, there's a report of a crash blocking the northbound left lane at 16th Street. In Phoenix right now, it's 71 degrees at 11:26.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The so-called Stand Your Ground law is in effect in 22 states, including Arizona. According to the National Council of State Legislatures, at least 9 of those states use specific language that a person may stand his or her ground in response to a suspected attacker. Even with that number of states, it's safe to say most people were not familiar with the term until the case of George Zimmerman shooting and killing Trayvon Martin in Florida in February of 2012. On Saturday afternoon at ASU's O'Connor College of Law's Great Hall, a Stand Your Ground community forum will be held, including a number of guest speakers and panelists, and two of them join me now. Martin Quesada is a Democratic state representative and a criminal defense attorney. Zig Popko is the founding director of the Post-Conviction Clinic at the O'Connor College of Law, where he teaches a sentencing seminar and workshop. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Zig, let's start off with where Arizona fits in as far as the Stand Your Ground law is concerned. What is the wording, and is there an actual Stand Your Ground phrase in there?
There is no actual Stand Your Ground phrasing. The way the Arizona statutes work it is that a person has no duty to retreat, and the duty to retreat part is the operative phrase.
And what's changed in Arizona? There was a change in 2010?
Yeah, there was. So here's what the law was. So before the Arizona Criminal Code was heavily revised in 1978, Arizona Supreme Court, even the territorial Supreme Court, held there's no duty to retreat. If you're being where you are lawfully and you're minding your own business and somebody attacks you, you can defend yourself. In 1978, the new criminal code came into provision, which said that you could only use deadly force if it was immediately necessary. And in 1981, the Arizona Supreme Court said, well, if you had the ability to retreat, that's a factor the jury could consider whether or not it was immediately necessary. And in 2010, the statute essentially removed that kind of duty.
Martin, since you're the politician, or I'll ask you this. When it comes to public policy, is there something indicative to you when, in 2010, this idea that Governor Brewer signed this law that would change things, would change the how things were interpreted, does that indicate you a way Arizona is turning on this issue? Does it say something to you about that?
Absolutely. That change in the statute in 2010, reinforcing that there is no duty to retreat, it's a drastic change in policy. And it's a change that's guided by a lot of the influences that this bill came from, the ALEC influences, the NRA influences. This is a policy that says that because you have no duty to retreat, that violent action is a preferred action in situations where there might be other options.
And what concerns do you have? Is there a situation where this could lead to more situations? Is there any indication that there have been more situations related to this?
Well, I think that's one of the main concerns, is that we need to look and see if that's actually the case. Does this lead to more violence rather than less? Does this lead to more victims rather than less? And does this lead to does this do the exact opposite of its intent and create more violent situations? That's what we need to examine. That's what we need to study. And our thought from our perspective is that these laws do work in the opposite fashion in which they're intended.
Zeke, are you seeing any legal trends across the country that more states are interested in this kind of law?
I think because of the Zimmerman trial and what's been going on with that, a lot of states are thinking about it and talking about it. I don't know whether they're enacting them more or not. But to just pick up a point that was just made in terms of whether this is leading to more violence, people are studying that. There's a recent Texas A&M University study that came out not too long ago, and it was done by an economist and a grad student. And they looked at, and I don't have the study in front of me, but they looked at violent crimes going on with states that have enacted these Stand Your Ground laws. They find that murders generally are on the upswing, 7 to 9%, which to them was the statistically significant number. Mm-hmm. But they did not see a concomitant drop in assaults or violent assaults. So their tentative conclusions, at least, are that the Stand Your Ground laws aren't having the impact that the promoters want them to have.
As a legal expert, when you see laws like this going into effect by lawmakers across the country, whether it was 5 years ago or more recently than that, are you concerned about this? I know there's the fight occasionally between the judicial and the legislative branch and the executive branch, for example. Is there a concern that lawmakers are writing certain laws that maybe when you get down to it don't necessarily make sense from a legal point? They're more public policy questions than legal questions.
And that's that fine line. The judiciary is not supposed to be making policy decisions. We could argue about where that line is all the time. It is the legislature's job to pass laws that they think make good policy, but it's also the legislature's job to find out if that policy is actually working and to make tweaks to it if it's needed.
Martine, is that done enough, do you think? And that's something that could come up in January, I understand.
It is something that I propose to introduce in January. We do need a thorough review of this law, and let's see if it's working or if it's not working. That does happen. We do that every year. We reevaluate laws that we pass every single year. In fact, a large majority of the legislation that's introduced is a revision to a prior law that wasn't completely working the way that we wanted to. So to say that this law is different and that it shouldn't be reviewed is really going in the wrong direction. So that's exactly what we're doing. And the Texas A&M study is a perfect example of why they need to be reviewed.
What's your approach going to be in January? I know that our listeners are going to say, yeah, that's terrific, but you're also a Democrat. So how difficult is it going to be to get people to consider this issue when you're in the minority body?
Well, I am a Democrat. I'm coming from a minority perspective in the legislature, but I don't believe that a review of laws is a partisan issue. There have been Republican members that have said, you know what, review of a law is a good thing. It is a smart thing to do. We do that with all the other, with every agency, with lots of other bills, and we've had public support from Republican members that have said a review is not a bad thing.
Let's psychoanalyze a bit. When laws like this come up, is there the feeling that lawmakers, and this has been something Democrats and Republicans both do this, they want to appear tough on crime in the sense that they're protecting perhaps homeowners, that sort of thing, or people who are out and being threatened by unknown criminals, or perhaps they are. Is that a concern of yours, this idea that it could just be something to grab onto as opposed to being good law?
Well, I think that's what this law has been from the very beginning. It's been more of a political statement. It's been more of a campaign tactic rather than good public policy. And we need to eventually get away from that at the legislature and review these and see if it is good public policy. And that's what we're going to be asking to happen come January.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. I'm talking with Martine Quezada, a Democratic state representative and criminal defense attorney. Also here is Zig Popko, the founding director of the Post-Conviction Clinic at the O'Connor College of Law, where he teaches a sentencing seminar and workshop. Zig, we're talking about the issue, and it got a lot of hype when it came to the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case. How important an issue is this for us to address?
I think it's an important issue because what the legislature did by changing the statute, and I'm not saying it's necessarily a good or bad thing, what the legislature did by changing the statute in 2010 was taking an issue away from the jury. The Arizona Supreme Court said in 1981, whether or not there was a safe opportunity to retreat or not, that's up for the jury to decide if the use of deadly force was immediately necessary. By changing the statute the way they did in 2010, the legislature said, you know, we're not even going to let the jury approach that issue, and we're just saying there is no duty to retreat.
Martine, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, taking that question away from the jury is a problem. Those are situations in which a jury of one's peers can look at that issue and determine, was it reasonable? Was this person reasonable in acting in the fashion that they did? Because we've enacted this policy now, we have told the public, we've communicated to them that your preferred method of dealing with these situations is violent action, is to use deadly force. That shouldn't always be the case. I think as a society, we should be striving to find the opposite, to find other ways to deal with these deadly situations.
Zeke, take us back about a decade or so. Harold Fish, I think, was the name of the person. I think it's a case that people who've lived here for a while may have heard of. Do you remember the background on it? There was someone hiking, and then he was with his dog, and one person felt threatened. How does that fit into... Would that have been sort of a precursor to Stand Your Ground?
It's related, and from my memory of it, the big issue there was who had the burden of proof, whether or not the person who did the shooting was acting in self-defense or not. The legislature, I forget exactly when, but sometime, maybe it was part even of the 78 criminal code revision that we had, changed the burden of proof, where the defendant had to prove by believe it was a preponderance of the evidence, that they were acting in self-defense. And in 2006, as a result of the Harold Fish case, a legislation was passed which basically restored what had been the prior law, which was that the prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was not acting in self-defense.
At its most obvious core, how much does that change things?
It changes things a lot. And I think if you talk to any prosecutor, they now realize that they have a fairly substantial burden of trying to prove that the defendant did not act reasonably. And they bear the risk of non-persuasion, that we call it.
Martine, on Saturday you'll be appearing on a panel with fellow lawmakers, both Republicans, John Kavanaugh and Eddie Farnsworth. Are there certain things you would like to come out in that discussion? Are there certain things that you might be surprised if you heard from your fellow lawmakers, or do you know exactly where they stand?
I think we know pretty much where they stand. They believe this is a good law. They believe this is a necessary law, and this is a Second Amendment issue is what this conversation usually evolves into. However, what I would like to see come out of that is an agreement amongst all of us that a review is not a bad thing. A review doesn't predetermine that it's going to be a good review or a bad review, but simply a review to see if things are working. As talking to experts, talking to prosecutors, talking to our defense bar, talking to the courts, and seeing what are the effects that this law is having on the state of Arizona.
Say, go ahead.
Just one point that I think the supporters of these types of laws, no duty to retreat laws, would say is part of what needs to be part of that conversation is when a person shoots and uses deadly force, they've already presumably been the victim of some kind of an assailant. And they fear that if they have to either prove that they acted in self-defense or prove that they could not retreat safely, they're being re-victimized by the system again. And I think that's part of their concerns, and that should be part of any conversation.
Only a minute or so left. Martine, you mentioned Alec, and Zig, I want to start with you. Is there concern from a legal or policy standpoint that there's a trend of laws across the country that perhaps this doesn't apply to Stand Your Ground, but in general, this idea that maybe there are groups left and right that want you to write this legislation, and it should be in many states, not just really an Arizona concern?
It pretty much is the case on this type of statute, and presumably with others as well. There are organizations out there. The NRA was a big motivating agency involved in the Florida enactment of Stand Your Ground and pushed it across, the ALEC organization that Martine mentioned. So that's happening.
Martine, a few seconds.
Yeah, the influence of organizations like ALEC on legislatures throughout the country is tremendous, and it's something that needs to be reviewed and discussed.
Democratic State Representative Martine Quezada, Zig Popko, founding director of the Post-Conviction Clinic at the O'Connor College of Law. Gentlemen, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Coming up on Saturday afternoon, ASU's O'Connor College of Law will host a Stand Your Ground community forum, including a number of guest speakers and panelists. Stay tuned. More to come on Here and Now with Eileen Klein of the Board of Regents and Mark Kelly, perhaps better known as husband of Gabrielle Giffords.
KJZZ is supported by Perkins Coie LLP, more than 900 lawyers in 19 offices across the U.S., including Phoenix and Asia, provide a full array of corporate, litigation, and intellectual property services. Online at PerkinsCoie.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM. In the Valley forecast, it'll be mostly cloudy today. We should see a high near 76 degrees. Mostly cloudy again on Thursday, and we've got a 50% chance of rain in the afternoon. Stay with us at 12 o'clock for NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Today, the attempted murder-suicide by a Virginia state senator's son is drawing attention to the issues facing mental health patients and the women who worked in the Kennedy White House in important yet little recognized roles. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on 91.5. It's mostly sunny in Phoenix, 71 degrees at 11:39.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last Wednesday, I spoke with University of Arizona President Ann Weaver Hart and Northern Arizona University President John Hager about elements that have them cautiously optimistic about higher education in Arizona. But neither one was convinced that state funding for universities was going to return to pre-recession levels. The Arizona Board of Regents has released its budget request, the money it will ask state lawmakers and the governor to allocate to universities in the 2015 fiscal year. With me to talk about that and the region's overall vision is Board of Regents President Eileen Klein. Eileen, $107 million is the figure that I saw that's being requested by the universities in additional funding for the next fiscal year. Can you lay that out?
The regents have approved the request of the presidents for an appropriation of around $100 million, and it is designed to provide primarily operating support for the universities. And as we know, the universities lost a tremendous amount of public aid from the state in particular during the downturn, about $500 million. So this is not an effort necessarily to recapture those dollars. It's really an effort to address the most critical needs so that we can stay on track, making sure that we're hitting our graduation and research goals.
Where does performance-based funding fit in?
Several years back, when the state was able to contribute resources to the public universities more than they can do today, they really were funding based on the number of students who came through the door. So there's a formula based on growth, and for a certain number of new students who came through the door, the universities received additional dollars. And it became apparent that that wasn't necessarily the best match with really trying to incent universities and really recognize universities for their contributions in the areas that the state cares the most about, which again is producing more college graduates and really increasing the research activity of the state that really is a key economic driver. So the regents worked closely with the presidents to come up with, and the governor's office, it was a request of the governor's office as well, that we really think about how we revamp the financial model so that we could support our universities in very targeted areas, make sure that we were achieving these goals that the state needed us to be accomplishing, and to really just think differently, knowing that resources weren't going to be coming back the way that they had been given before.
Let's talk about bonding, which was an interesting part of the proposal. I mean, it seemed very bold, this idea of about $1 billion in research facilities for the three universities. Give us some background on that.
As a companion piece, really, to the operating dollars this year, the university presidents felt that it was really important to accelerate our research agenda. So for the year 2020, the state has established very aggressive research goals. We'd like to double the research volume to about $2 billion per year among the three state universities. To be able to do that, we're clearly going to need the buildings, the equipment, all of the infrastructure really that is necessary to attract the top research faculty. This is a very competitive environment, so to get the top researchers in any particular area, we need to make sure that we have the facilities to enable them to work with large teams. So, you know, whether it's big research teams or very highly specialized teams, they need access to the latest in equipment and the space to be able to do their work. So the presidents put together an agenda building off of the success of a similar proposal that had been advanced by the legislature and supported by the legislature in 2003, and recognized that we would need from the state about $1 billion worth of bonding capacity to be allowed, in essence, for us to begin constructing over the next several years the facilities. This proposal worked very successfully in 2003, and the returns to the state have been pretty incredible. So with this new package, we anticipate that between the years, you know, 2017 and 2021, for instance, we'll be able to add about $3 billion worth of state gross product just by virtue of having made this commitment from the state to research infrastructure.
Are there certain areas of research the three presidents are especially excited about?
Well, it certainly will help advance the research agenda broadly among the universities. But there's a particular play, I think, to be made among the biosciences. So some of those activities have been prioritized, largely because the regents and presidents have been trying to work closely with entities like the State Chamber of Commerce, the Arizona Commerce Authority, to really make sure that we're working with industry leaders to be aligned in terms of what they think we need to help accelerate and propel the state's opportunities in particular economic sectors. So the biosciences is certainly a terrific opportunity, and these buildings, for example, will really help increase research capacity in those areas. And I should be clear that it's not just basic research that's being supported, it's also the ability to propose research projects that eventually translate into the private sector, into the marketplace that companies can use in their daily business. Likewise, in the case of NAU, as part of this package, it will also help them build out some capacity to augment their healthcare programs to provide some and fulfill some critical shortage in healthcare workers that we need and in the allied health fields in particular.
You were someone who had the good fortune in some ways and not good fortune in others to work in the governor's office. And there has been this criticism that some lawmakers, and actually a pretty high percentage, don't necessarily equate a great value with higher education. So what's the next step?
Certainly, it's still a challenging environment. We respect that the state is still recovering. We're thrilled to see the advances the state's made. And I think in large part it's been because we've had policymakers very focused on what needs to be done in terms of setting the state's policy agenda, you know, putting things in the right direction. For us, we feel like the universities play a critical role. So we know that the better, the more educated, really, the society is, that the better off people are going to be as individuals, and the better off the economy is going to be. And so we're able to demonstrate time and again that the higher the educational attainment of a state, then the better off the state's going to be. It pays off tremendously in terms of economic development, not just from having a high number of degreed graduates, but also by having these research collaboratives that businesses want to be near. They want to be near that top flight talent, and they want to benefit from those spinoffs. I mean, when you think about it, you know, ASU, from over the past 10 years, because of their research infrastructure investment, they've had 64 new companies generated. So the really the economics have been undeniable. The question, again, is the availability of resources. And we feel like as the state begins to recover, the general fund is able to, again, begin to recommit to different areas of expenditure that higher education absolutely must be prioritized. It's very clear to us that there's a tremendous economic return, but it's also clear that we've got to have that commitment made by the legislature if we're going to hit these goals that they've set forward for the state.
We talked briefly about the biosciences before, and that was a very hot industry when the economy was going well. And could you compare a little bit the difference between 2003 and now? 2003, things seemed to be, we were just coming out of a recession again, but I think people were more optimistic at that point than maybe they are now.
You know, in every area, we're starting to see recovery. But the point is that, you know, many businesses have made it through the downturn, thankfully, right? And so we want to be sure that we aren't losing ground on the advances that have been made, you know, by attracting huge collaboratives and research like TGen. You know, those were foundational, and they were really important in terms of advertising to the world that we really do have a cache of resource here that can really be important, not just to Arizona, but nationally and internationally. So we felt like by prioritizing our agenda, we could really help augment and accelerate the build out and, you know, supply chain in key industries, both through talent and then obviously what we're able to contribute in terms of the research agenda. So the point isn't to engineer the economy. The point is to identify where we have opportunities and how we can bring to bear the vast resources of the universities to help propel success.
Eileen, finally, during the worst of the recession, it seemed in a sense lawmakers didn't have a lot of choices. At least they were going to make cuts to certain areas, and money was not going to be added to other areas. In the sense now that we're in a recovery, the general fund is doing better, is this going to be actually more difficult because lawmakers are going to have some choices and they're going to have to really prioritize, do we want to give this money to higher education?
There are certainly plenty of choices. It seems like a never-ending list of choices, I'm sure, for legislators. But there are some fundamentals, and I think the policymakers, our legislators, really do recognize and respect that the Constitution has also set some priorities. One of those happens to be at the education system, including higher education, our public universities. Thankfully, they recognize how serious the crisis was several years back, you know, having to make those terrible choices to reduce budgets and eliminate or reduce services for people, services that people count on, that thankfully has not left their memory. And so they want to be cautious. They're right to be cautious. Our point is simply that we have to help policymakers make good decisions, that even in times, you know, where things are challenging, you still have to be willing to, you know, take some risks about building the future. So just like with any good company, they wouldn't just strictly cut during a downturn. They'd certainly continue to think about where's the right place to prioritize our resources, where are the right places to reinvest or to invest and expand. And that's really the message here. It's that we want to encourage policymakers that they are right, certainly, to be cautious, but you don't want to be overly cautious that, you know, this state's going to be the growth corridor, not just for the West, but probably most of the United States going forward. And so we have to have the state in a position that it can support those demands of growth and really grow in a way that's going to prosper the people of the state.
Arizona Board of Regents President Eileen Klein. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. January 8, 2011, the shootings by Jared Loughner at a Tucson Safeway destroyed a number of lives and transformed countless others. The incident has left former Representative Gabrielle Giffords still working on therapy to overcome the brain injury she suffered. On Friday night at 8, the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts will host Giffords and her husband, former astronaut Mark Kelly, in an event called Endeavor to Succeed. Mark Kelly joins me now. Mark, how is your wife doing?
Gabby is doing great. You know, she continues to work really hard on her recovery. She does, you know, speech therapy and occupational and physical therapy. You know, and she takes it very seriously, and she's continuing to improve. And it's coming up on 3 years since she was injured.
The past 2.5 years, people thought of you before that successful astronaut. Obviously, you had a lot of courage to try that. But I imagine the last 2.5 years have been a test like you never imagined you'd have.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it turned out that, you know, one of the greatest challenges of my life was not flying in combat or flying into space 4 times, but it was dealing with the aftermath of what happened to Gabby on January 8th of 2011 when she was injured and 6 of her constituents were murdered. And so I learned a lot from that experience. And I also applied a lot of the lessons I learned along the way, you know, as a pilot in the United States Navy and while working at NASA too. You know, so it's been quite the learning experience. You know, it was a tragic day, I think, in our, you know, country's history. We seem to have, you know, occasionally have some of these days.
I did want to ask you about your efforts and Representative Giffords' efforts when it comes to changing certain aspects of gun legislation. It doesn't seem like much progress has been made on that, despite your efforts. What's your reaction to that? Have you been surprised?
Well, not only despite our efforts, but, you know, despite what happened nearly a year ago when we had 20 first graders murdered in their classrooms. I mean, it's obvious. I think it's obvious to everybody that we have, you know, we have a problem in this country. We've got a much higher rate of death from gun violence than any other industrialized country, on the order of 15 times higher. And, you know, and when you have, you know, 20 first graders die in such a horrific way, you think there would be some sort of national reaction from our leaders in Washington, D.C., and that hasn't happened yet. And we've been working really hard to try to get them to take some positive steps, like passing a bill that would expand background checks to gun shows and the internet. But we've come short so far. We got kind of close. It's obvious to me that, you know, this is going to take some time, but, you know, I think as a country, we'll get there.
Since you've been in the thick of the battle with this, even if, as you said, maybe something will happen in the future, why hasn't it happened now, even as it seems like there's progress?
Well, it's political, right? It's not, I don't think it's policy. I think it's politics. You know, there's, there's certain organizations that have a lot of influence in Washington, D.C. It has to do with how members of Congress think about their next election. And they didn't build that influence overnight, so it's not going to go away overnight. And, you know, our role, I think, is to provide just an effective counterbalance to allow members of Congress to vote their conscience on this issue. You know, I've talked to some that, you know, their vote doesn't exactly reflect how they feel about it. unfortunate.
Do you think this will be an important issue in the 2014 congressional races? Are you going to try to make it one?
Well, I think it will be. You know, it hasn't gone away. And, you know, when you see mass shootings at a greater frequency and you still see a very high death rate from gun violence, unless we take some steps to change, whether it's the procedure for how you get a background check before buying a gun or who gets entered into the national into criminal background check system, you don't make changes there and make it harder for criminals and the dangerously mentally ill to get a gun, you wouldn't expect those numbers to go down. And as we've seen since Newtown, you know, we've had other mass shootings in Santa Monica and then at the Washington Navy Yard. So if we don't make some changes, it's not going to go. The problem's just not going to go away. So I think it will be a issue in the 2014 election.
How much do you want mental health to be part of that package? I mean,
It's a huge part of it. You would have thought Congress would have acted, especially on something that, you know, that most people agree on, that, you know, probably not the daily gun violence in this country, which are really the big numbers, but the ones that get the national attention, like Newtown or what happened in Tucson or Aurora, there is always some mental health aspect of those. You know, typically the person is dangerously mentally ill. Often people knew about it. You know, if you get these folks treatment, I think on a lot of these cases they would have never done, you know, what they did. So, you know, we continue to work with Congress to, you know, try to affect some change there in you know, with mental health. We used to have a pretty good mental health system in this country. You know, I had a former governor of Texas just tell me the other day, told Gabby and I, he said, and he was kind of being sarcastic, but he said, you know what the mental health system now is in the state of Texas? He said it's the county jail, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can really do better than that.
Going back briefly to January 8th, 2011, did you ever say, why us? And if so, how did you get past it?
No, I don't do that. You know, Gabby doesn't do that. She looks forward. You know, sometimes bad things happen to good people, and, you know, you can't go back in time, and you just got to do the best to move forward. And, you know, Gabby continues to work really hard to try to, you know, improve the lives of others, you know, whether it's regard to gun violence or, you know, traumatic brain injury, like, you know, this event on Friday is, you know, we're going to be there for the Brain Injury Alliance of Arizona,
right,
which does a lot of great work in not only connecting families to professionals, you know, to help with people that have traumatic brain injury, but also, you know, trying to prevent people from getting traumatic brain injuries and all this other stuff associated with it. It's amazing how many people in this country in their lifetime will suffer a traumatic brain injury. It's millions.
In interviewing people about Alzheimer's disease and progress in that, for example, or even Valley Fever, interviewed a scientist about that last week, the talk is sometimes great progress is made when someone who's in the public eye has something like this happen. Do you think the awful thing that happened in Tucson is actually going to help make huge progress in brain injuries?
Yeah, well, we hope so. I mean, you know, we hope that, you know, this didn't happen to Gabby and Christina Taylor Green and Judge John Roll and, you know, so many others. You know, I'm talking about the folks that were killed on that day. You know, that this doesn't happen and just nothing positive comes out of it. Something positive needs to. And whether that's educating people and helping them, you know, get treatment for a family member who has traumatic brain injury or preventing at least some of deaths, you know, from gun violence. I mean, it's, you know, the tragedy in itself is awful. But I think what's really tragic is if you don't try to turn it into something positive. And that's what Gabby's trying to do.
My last question for you is the inevitable question, which I have to ask you, of course.
How do you go to the bathroom in space? Is that what you're going to ask me?
No, I was going to. Well, actually, that's much more important. No, I was going to. Are you going to run for office at some point?
You know, Gabby was a politician in our family. I'm not somebody that ever thought I would run for office. You know, I watch, you know, how difficult it is for members of Congress to get things done in Washington. So I don't have a great desire to be, you know, up there as, as part of that. I mean, in a way, I guess I am a little bit on the outside. But I would never say never. I mean, under the right circumstances, if I felt that maybe I was the person that could, you know, contribute in a little bit different way and could be helpful, I would certainly consider it, but it's not something on my to-do list.
Captain Kelly, thanks for the time.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve.
Captain Mark Kelly and former Representative Gabrielle Giffords will be at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts Friday night at 8 in a presentation called Endeavor to Succeed. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to Nick Blumberg for his help on today's program. Thanks very much to you for listening. If you'd like to hear this program or any past editions, go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. Now we head to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance, collecting frozen turkeys at the Super Saturday Turkey Drive this Saturday at 15 Valley locations, working to fill emergency food boxes for the